class about 5 or 6, 8 years ago, is giving a lecture tonight. She is with Skidmore, Owings & Merrill. And come on. Well, apparently I'm not connected to the internet. That's the problem. Connected. Okay, one more try here. Integrity recording is in progress. Okay. Says. Well, we'll hope that this records it. So what I failed to mention is that this is the origin of the concept of streets named after trees and indexed. A, B, C, D, E, F, G, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. The streets that ran between the two rivers, the Schuylkill and the Delaware, are named after trees, locust, cherry, juniper, peach tree, myrtle, etc. And the streets that run parallel to the river, starting at about 30th Street, going down here to 1st Street. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. This was intentional on Penn's part, and is integral to his plan to create this, quote, city of brotherly love, because he wanted to destroy traditional forms of social hierarchy. In other words, what we might call the eunomic, to use a Greek term, eunomic order, which is an order that's based upon status or merit, status in the community. It could be a good thing or it could be a bad thing. And certainly coming on the heels of kings and monarchs and so forth, he wanted to create a sort of level playing field. And so the idea is that, you know, if you lived at Tottenham Court Road in London, it would mean that you probably had some proximity to or association with the crown or with nobility. Whereas if you live at 34 Fifth Street, that's no different than 34 6th Street. You know, the dictionary is just A, B, C, D, E, the first letter. It doesn't say that C is better than P or something like that. And so there was an attempt to create what I would call an isonomic order, which is simply an indexical system that allows you, like polar coordinates, allows you to locate in space for property transfers, for the delivery of mail, for to have an address in the world, but there's no hierarchy in relation to any traditional form of authority, right? If I lived in Edinburgh at Bishopsgate or something, then I would probably be associated with the church, right? So here it's just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and then these streets that are named except for the two main ones, this being Broad Street and this being originally King Street, but quickly changed to Market Street, which is another characteristic of North American cities in the United States in the 19th century, all of which bear some parts of them, or in some cases all of them, actually are taking Philadelphia, the Philadelphia plan, as a kind of precedent. We even see Savannah, where after the middle of the 19th century, they start numbering streets and so forth, again, an imitation of Philadelphia. Now, these things come and go out of fashion. I do not believe that we have built a street that had numbers anywhere in the United States, at least since World War II, which is a long time, 60, 70 years. But for 120 years or more, we built lots of these streets because it was seen as being a sort of this indexical system as being a good thing. The other characteristic of this is that peculiarly in the United States, you have streets that are simply named after function, like Main Street. I mean, not very imaginative, not very poetic. Broad Street, it's just descriptive, all right? So let's talk about this for a moment here in terms of the conceptual differences of streets. Very important. Street comes from a Latin word, stratum, strata, like the Italian strata, right? Which comes from what? A material condition, being paved. So in the medieval world in Europe, the old Roman, say, Roman Britain, the highway, the via, the way, becomes the high street when it moves from outside the gate of the city into the city. You follow me? So strata, street, comes from what? I just said it. The material, the actual constructional material. Road actually comes from rut, the same etymological root as rut, meaning it's, you know, tracks in the mud somewhere, a rut. A rad, a wheel rad, it's a Norse word that comes into English through the Viking world. Then we have streets like Tottenham Court Road that, well, Marietta Street. What is the significance of Marietta Street? It takes me to Marietta. Okay? Right? Tottenham Court Road, which would be associated with nobility. What about Fifth Street? What does that indicate? In and of itself, nothing. It's just part of a larger indexical system which is intended to create this kind of level playing field that destroys traditional hierarchies based upon status in the community. Okay? Does that make sense to everybody? Yes. Correct. Yeah, starting here. No, not always. In fact, it gets really confusing. Gainesville, Florida. Anybody here from Gainesville? No? University of Florida? Gainesville did follow certain precedents here, but they divided into northeast, northwest, southwest, southeast. And so there's a southeast 3rd Street and a southwest 3rd Street and a northwest 3rd Street. And if you don't know that up front, if you don't have prior knowledge, you will spend the better part of an afternoon looking for an address on 3rd Street, but you're in the wrong quarter of the city. Okay? So there was no particular pattern east to west or west to east. In the case of Gainesville, my guess is they would start in the center, quarter it, and then name everything. So 3rd Street continues, but it's southwest 3rd Street and southeast 3rd Street. If you go to 99 3rd Street, you don't know whether you're in the southeast or the southwest quarter up front, then you're in a lot of trouble, right? So you would always have, in Gainesville, you would always have to know what quarter of the city you were in, okay? Ordinary language, before we get into this, ordinary language often tells us a lot about things, I believe, the way we use ordinary language. For example, if you were giving someone directions to Georgia Tech from the airport, you would say, well, you get on the freeway north, and then you get off at 10th Street, let's say, okay? But if you're going to meet somebody for lunch at the Barrel House over here, you would say, or at the Georgia Tech Hotel, you would say what? It is at the intersection of 5th and Spring. Now, what's the difference there? You get off, right, as opposed to at. So at implies a coordinate, like latitude and longitude, right? Off means what? It's like a conveyor belt, and you get off of it. So one might think, then, that from how we just colloquially use ordinary language in these descriptions, that freeways are, in fact, not a street. In this sense, they are something else, like a mechanical system, like an HVAC diagram or something, right? Okay, I just love these maps. I showed these to you at the end last time. This is an English map showing Georgia. It goes all, goes all the way to the Mississippi. They had no idea what was out there. In fact, this is the Chattahoochee. And we know now the Chattahoochee cuts through Atlanta at an angle like this. This is the Spanish map, which shows Florida's real big, The Caribbean is big. The Spanish colonial parts are big. And then Lake Erie is, well, there's a lake in here called Lake Grand, which is doesn't exist anywhere that I'm aware of. And then Lake Erie is somewhere just above Highlands, North Carolina, it looks like, you know, or Chattanooga. They've collapsed the distance, which tells you something about this area, which will be the subject of part of the lecture today. Okay. So Georgia is the last of these English colonies. And in its initial projection, it was a very it was very different from the others. First, it was the crown was more interested in this colony than in the others because of the Spanish presence in Florida. And what they wanted was a military outpost that could defend the economically important port of Charleston and these plantations that are on these long navigable rivers going up through the Carolinas. So they there was a military presence in Georgia that was not that was more or less absent in Tidewater in other parts of the Tidewater South. Now, because it was the last, there had been a lot of competition among a variety of people to create this colony here, and one of the proposals was from a guy named Sir Robert Montgomery, a nobleman who wanted to create, in 1717, he published a treatise called the Margravate of Azilia, hoping that he could get crown support. This rather fanciful and absurd diagram of his, this is not the city of Savannah. This is the entire colony of Georgia, all right, which was to be organized this way as a kind of feudal barony with Sir Robert's castle right in the middle of it, and then this this sort of affinity here to Penn's plan for Philadelphia is obvious. This is, each one of these is a square mile. Fortunately for us, this never went anywhere. I can't imagine teaching for 37 years at Azilia Tech, but that was an example of one of many. Now, what they thought, if you go back to the original sort of propaganda piece that I showed you about Virginia, they said we can grow oranges and lemons and plums and all these things, and we can have silk and so forth. Well, a group of investors known as the trustees of the Corporation of Georgia, flattered the king by naming it after him, was in fact that, you know, based on this notion they could do this, that they could grow silk here. Now, none of them, there were 21 of them, none of them had ever set foot in the New World. None of them, right? But they were convinced, absolutely convinced, that they could grow silk here. Why? Because latitude, which was fairly easy to develop based on the azimuths of the sun, longitude was the difficult part, right? Georgia, was roughly in the same latitude as the silk-growing region of China. Therefore, we should be able to grow silk. Based on this abstract, preposterous notion, they actually, and reports of mulberry trees growing here in great abundance, they invested huge sums of money in establishing this colony. They hired a man named James Edward Oglethorpe, who was a former general and traveled in these same intellectual circles in the West End of London that people like William Penn did. And they hired him, actually, as military engineer to establish this colony. They also had, I would say, the historian Daniel Borstein has called it, in his book, The Americans, the Colonial Experience, titles the chapter on Georgia, Victims of Philanthropy. And I think that's a great sort of ironic concept, that the people who came here were victims of these trustees' philanthropy. It was very high-minded. There was to be no alcohol. there was to be, you couldn't drink spirits. All the land was to be collectively owned. You got a, based on this lease system that I described at Bedford Square, the trustees would retain ownership of the ground, of the land, and then they would give you, as a colonist, a 60 by 90 foot lot that we see here, where you could actually have your house. And in return, and then we would give you 5 acres of common land that you would then use to graze your cow or grow your vegetables. And then there was 45 acres that would be given that in return that were to be put into silk production. They hired a man named Nicolas Amatis, a Frenchman, who claimed to know how to make silk. It turned out he didn't. It took 8 years, and in the first 8 years, they produced enough silk to make one dress, which they sent back to England to give to the Queen. In the 10th year, they had invested 10 times more than they could ever possibly have imagined that they could have made in return, and so they abandoned the colony completely. Now, that is significant, and it is significant because it means that the thing that created it was, in fact, taken away, and it was simply on its own to develop any way it naturally would develop. I should also mention that slavery was prohibited, that you could not will property at your death. The land reverted back to the trustees, who would then reassign it to someone else. They had great difficulty in getting people to come here. They created all kinds of propaganda about what a wonderful place. There are all these fruits growing everywhere. You're going to become wealthy. If you were poor in England or anywhere else in Europe, if you had come up, your family didn't own land, the opportunity to own land was, at that point in time, 1733, that was a big deal. But they had great difficulty with it, so they got anybody that they could. The second oldest Jewish congregation in the United States, what's now the United States, was here in Savannah. A group of religious group from Austria called Salzburgers who came and settled in a twin city up to Savannah called Ebenezer. Nothing remains of it except a graveyard and a church. It was, the whole thing was just an absolute economic disaster. This is what it looked like 1 year after its founding, according to this engraver, Gordon, known as Gordon's View, of 1734. Now, the question of the origin of this unique plan, which is a series of wards, which we'll get into in a moment, built around a series of squares, is unique in both the United States and in the world. And so the question of the origin of the plan has been a great historical puzzle for a long period of time. No document, unlike Philadelphia, no document has ever been found, right? Nothing. And the historian John Reps, believes that, in fact, it is based upon an Italian, he's written two papers on this, one claiming that it was derived from this Italian, the first one based on these settlements in Northern Ireland called Londonderry, and the second one is the Piazza Carlina in Torino, which Oglethorpe apparently had visited. And so he's putting two and two together, and he's coming up with about 7.5. There's no evidence. Oglethorpe never wrote, never extolling the virtues of the Piazza Carlina. But if you look at it, what you see is a certain kind of formal affinity between this and this. In a lecture at 2005 at SCAD down in Savannah, Rep said that it came from the Piazza Carlina. I went up to him and asked him, do you have any actual evidence of that? The answer was a roundabout no. This is Londonderry that we see here in Northern Ireland, and I've given the source of these. Well, I think the search for the source is in some ways a red herring. I'm not even sure Oglethorpe drew the plan. I think it may have been Robert Castell, a friend of his, who was in prison because he owed a lot of money. He was an engraver and an architect, and he might, in fact, have drawn the actual plan. But again, that's kind of irrelevant. I think it was based upon Newcourt's plan, but Reps discounts this because, in fact, it was not published until later. Although certainly everybody from William Penn to James Edward Oglethorpe that traveled in those same intellectual circles would have been familiar with it. In any event, what we see is I find this fascinating at a number of levels. Clearly, they feared the Spanish more than they feared the indigenous population, because it turns out that the Yamacraw Indians who lived here were, in fact, friendly. They, you know, this came late. They said, you know, there's no point in fighting this. They're coming by the boatload. So let's welcome them in and sort of try to figure out how we can all sort of come to some advantage. The other thing I like about it is that the preacher was put outside. They even bent the palisade here to exclude the minister, the preacher, from the community. I think that's hilarious. This is the public oven. This is the home for strangers, etc. One French observer by the 1760s had written that Savannah was down to 1/6 of its original population. Well, if it was down to 1/6 of that, there wasn't very much going on there, right? But as cotton became king, and as the Industrial Revolution began to produce the textile industry in places like Manchester in England, cotton became a very important export crop, and so it began to grow as a port city. It's actually upriver. It's not on the ocean. It's actually upriver, 20 miles on a bluff. This actually then shows the relationship of the 5-acre lots to the 45-acre lots to the actual city. You can read this over here on the left in the sidebar. That is required text. You may ask that on a question. Now, what I find, what we can learn from here is several things, one of which is that there are only two types of lots: a public lot called a trust lot and a private lot called a tithing lot. Now, the tithing is an archaic English word. It's still in use. If some of you go to church, you know that you're supposed to tithe 10% of your income. Come on. Why is this not doing what it's supposed to be doing? It's tithing. It's an archaic word which means a tenth. I'll just leave it here. And so there were four blocks of tithing lots in a larger cell, a cellular unit known as a ward, W-A-R-D. And there were four of these originally. Eventually it was expanded to six. And by the time they abandoned this system in about 1850, they were up to 22 of these wards. The tithing lots were 60 by 90 feet. They were the individual lots. And the trust lots were 60 feet wide and the longitudinal dimension running parallel to the river. What we see here, for example, this dimension that we see here varied. The blocks were 202 feet 6 inches by 300 feet. There's that 300-foot dimension again. So the block could then be subdivided into five 60-foot frontage lots. And it is this network of dimensions here that allowed futures that could not possibly have been predicted by the trustees or by Oglethorpe or by anyone in 1733 to actually develop in the 19th century when the city began to grow. That is the significance of it. So if we look at this, we see then the relationship, houses toward the front of the lots. There's the public square. That's actually, I think, Johnson Square. None of the original buildings from the colonial period remain. This is actually a reconstruction based on Gordon's engraving that you just saw by a historical society or something, showing what one of these townhouses was supposed to be like. Now, the significance of this is that from two lots, both rectangles, turned orthogonally to one another, the tithing lots the residential lots and the trust lots, you could then create what was essentially a diagram of Filarete's ideal city. The problem with that is that there were only 40 people living there, 40 families, not enough for a city. There's more than 40 people in this room, right? And so they made the decision, and this was a critical decision, to replicate the entire ward here, here, and here as a unit. And what that produced out of two lots was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 kinds of streets. Five streets, different types of streets out of this simple assemblage of 60 by 90 foot and 60 by variable width or length lots. And over time, then, as the undesignated space in the center developed as these little park-like squares, they tended then to be experienced as objects, because this one was in dialogue with this one, and this one was in dialogue with this one. But if we go back and look at this diagram, the question would be, where would you put City Hall? Where would you put the courthouse? Where would you put the public building? What's the center of that? Doesn't really have one. It's just the intersection of two streets. So this meant that they had to go outside the system here, and at the bottom of the diagram that I drew here, to build City Hall. So as more wards were added, you tend, as you do today, to experience this as a series of squares, related squares. That's how every architect I've ever seen or known draws this. They start with the squares. The squares were the residual of the subdivision, not the object that came first. They came last. Okay? In fact, they weren't even squares. They were ovals. Streets went through them, all kinds of things. But that is experientially how you actually experience the city when you go there today. And so the squares over time took on different functions depending upon the nature of the use of the land that surrounded them. So if it was in the file that related to City Hall, as we'll see in a moment, then you got monuments to heroes of various types. Tomachichi, the chief of the Yamacraw, was actually buried in one of them. Nathaniel Green, this hero of the revolution, is buried in one of them, etc. And then if it's a residential area, it's simply a little park where you can go sit and have tea, read a newspaper, and watch your grandchildren play. The lots were, this is very important, were not uniform. I mentioned earlier square lots are not good because there's no inherent bias in the diagram. There's an inherent bias in this diagram, even though the ward is square, 670 feet on a side. The lots themselves have a bias. This is in this direction facing the square. This is in this direction facing the river. This direction facing the river. This direction facing the square. And that meant that over time, land uses that were related to, that were similar, long before zoning, could aggregate along streets where it had a similar land use across the street from it, like this. So you would see that those things that faced on the trust lots, there weren't enough public buildings to fill it all out, so they became everything from parking decks to churches, faced this public square. And then the alley in the back split it in such a way that this was a ready-made back and this was a ready-made front. This is that English mews system that splits the block in the middle like so with an alley. That meant this land use could change and without having to change this, right? That's fairly significant. And thus the shaded area that we see here develops as a commercial street over time without having to alter the uses that were, say, here. Right? Thus, you end up with through streets, or streets that are related to the squares, rather, like so. And then you have these one-way pairs today, which are the through streets that operate in the seams between the wards, like this, that carry traffic at 5 o'clock in the afternoon from downtown out to the south side of the suburb. Now, Savannah is turned at about a 45-degree angle facing the river, so south and north become really confusing here. And if you say southwest, northwest, northeast, it gets even more confusing. So in general, the further you move away from the river, if you go there today and say, where do you live? I live on the south side. They would know that it was further away from the river out one of these streets like Abercorn. So there we actually see one of these streets between the wards. These will develop then in the automobile age as suburban pairs, and the streets that run parallel to the river will develop land uses like Broughton Street that we see here, which is actually related to the binding of this use to the similar use that we see over here across the street on the other side. And thus you begin to get this kind of tartan plaid of things that are constantly moving through the city in this direction and moving through the city in this direction. So if I build City Hall here, I have now charged this file and this street, Bull Street, with a particular obligation. Thus, this is where we would expect to see the monuments, memorials on these public squares, whereas this might remain residential, whereas this might become city market, right? An economic function. The alleys become really critical. They are 22 feet, 6 inches wide. Now, they vary a little bit today. Some are 23 feet, 4 inches, but in the original plan, they were 22 feet, 6 inches, which conforms precisely to an ideal dimension in a 90-degree parking lot over here across the street. Isn't that amazing? You think that Oglethorpe knew that, that something called an automobile was going to be invented and that you would need a 22-foot drive aisle? Of course not. But what that meant is that you could service all these buildings from the back, so that you ended up then with dumpsters and fire escapes and all kinds of things moving down these alleys, these public alleys behind that are splitting the block, and it's operating that way, similar to Bedford Square, similar to this English system that we saw in those residential squares. And over time, it would then get built out. Occasionally, you would have anomalies within the system. As I mentioned, City Hall ends up being built here, which charges this. The Colonial Cemetery occupies part of a ward. There are certain buildings and land uses that won't fit in here, such as an airport. But it's remarkable when you think about it. Within this hierarchy of dimensions, which is very important, you could build, the World Trade Center footprint was 200 by 200 feet. This is 202 feet on a side. That's 300 feet. So one of the towers, twin towers of the World Trade Center would fit right there, okay? Empire State Building would fit on one of those blocks. It's really amazing. So this is then the Bull Street, the view from Johnson Square to City Hall, and there we see the monument, the obelisk in dialogue here with City Hall. And then this file of monuments that goes down this kind of civic spine, ending and being terminated here by the city park, Forsyth Park, that we see here that's built beginning in 1856, following Central Park in New York. And then this will be converted into the market functions. And then here along the river is actually the sort of industrial warehouse part, which is today called Factor's Walk. It's now a kind of entertainment district. There we see City Market. It was torn down in the 1950s when all the retail began to move out to the suburbs. And they were trying to create free parking. They recently actually dug it all up and put a parking deck underground, which is very difficult to do in Savannah, and created this sort of entertainment district called City Market and a park up on top of this today. Along the river, this section that we see here, you would bring the cotton or the crop, whatever it was, you would bring it in here, and then the offices were up above. These were called factors. They were British who were Could be French, could be anything, a European colonial sort of. The people who are buying the stuff up here, buying and selling, and then you would sort of download it into these warehouses that would then come out onto the quay, and the ships could pull up over here in the river, and you would load all this stuff onto the ships, as you see in the section diagram. Today, these are all lawyers and architects and dentists and people like that living and working in these offices. So here we see it then in 1875, looking down Bull Street with the original City Hall down at one end. We have two squares here, Johnson and Wright Square. And there, down at the bottom, you can actually see one of those 60-foot tithing lots. Now, the significance of the 60-foot dimension is critical because it can be subdivided into 20-foot or 30-foot bays, or it can be expanded like an accordion up to a dimension of 300 feet. A modern fire hose is 150 feet, so it's very efficient because you can put one fire hydrant in the center of a 300-foot block and stretch the hose all the way to the corner. Again, not something Oglethorpe, he would not have known about Dempster dumpsters and modern firefighting equipment in 1733, or Robert Castell, or the trustees, or whoever it was that actually developed this remarkable plan. Telfair Square, 1875, see the ships along the port on the river. It's now moved up river. And then here we see a postcard looking down Bull Street across Broughton into Johnson Square with City Hall in the background. And there we actually have it in 1957. There we see 1947. And there we see it in 2004. It's remarkable consistency within the four elements of the constitutional frame. So the significance here and what we learn from this is that this nested hierarchy of dimensions is very important. 70-foot lots are not very good. 60-foot lots are great, okay? For example, 70 feet, you're wasting 10 feet. Multiply that out hundreds of times. What do you do with that extra 10 feet? 50-foot lots, not so good because they can't be subdivided very easily, right? So here along Bay Street, we actually see that we can read the original tithing lots within the subdivision of 19th century buildings that we see here. In the diagram, Oglethorpe's tent was about right there. So a 30-foot column grid, such as the West Architecture Building, could be dropped into one of these tithing blocks, or we could subdivide it into 20-foot shoe stores with a service and dumpster and back of the house inventory here, or a townhouse with a garden in the back and enough room for parking. You need about a minimum of 37 and a half feet. Really, 40 is better to back a car up. And so particularly if it's a Ford Explorer or Cadillac Escalade or Ford F-150 or something. And so the 22-foot-six alley plus this plus that creates a kind of ideal dimension of a townhouse, or what the British would call a terrace house, of between 36 and 42 feet of depth. You don't want to go much deeper than 42 feet because you have problems getting light to the interior of the building. Question? Well, you're wasting 10 feet per lot. 60 is very efficient. It can be subdivided into even units of 20 and 30. Modern fire codes favor 30-foot column bays, for example. The West Architecture Building is a 30-foot column bay, right? You take this and then you ask yourself, how can I subdivide it or expand it to accommodate futures that I can't predict? And I think that's the obligation then of the urban designer, right? To accommodate futures that we can't particularly predict. So as the city grew, here we see the wards being expanded. This remarkable drawing from 1770 actually giving dimensions, some of which are wrong. And then as it begins to be built out, I've turned this map upside down so that it's oriented to the river in exactly the same way. The original four wards that you see are here. This was a bluff that went down into a low area, same over here. So this ward, for example, is shorter. There are only There are fewer lots across here. Interestingly, they were smart enough not to, going back to the 70-foot or 50-foot question, there are only four lots here where there are five here, so they cut a lot off of this rather than contracting it, distributing that 60-foot difference over the entire, taking 8 feet out of each lot or something. They were smart enough to do that. Now, certain things I mentioned, like this terrible civic center that got built somehow down here, the train station, which is now a visitor center, cemetery, and so forth, doesn't fit within this. Those are the twin towers of the World Trade Center right there. But it is remarkable the number of building types and land uses that can actually be accommodated within this hierarchy of dimensions. It is also remarkable that despite the fact that within 10 years, the people who created this gave up and went home, right? Just ate their investment and left. And yet the plan remains intact. The plan acted like a constitution, like a constitutional frame. So if we look at what the plan is, it is what? Boundaries and streets, the boundaries of forming lots, blocks and streets, public gathering places, and then eventually over time, monuments. And we see how consistent that plan has been over a long period of time, 280 years, almost 300 years, in accommodating all of the changes that have occurred in our world. So I want to make a very important point here, if you'll bear with me, that real history is not made by preserving old buildings or freezing the present into an ossified version of the past. Real history is made when each successive generation, subject to their own condition, can write their own story into a place. The stability of the public frame, the constitutional order, allows the representation of the present to fluctuate according to its own needs while assuring continuity between past and future. This photograph on the right is of a rally for General Ulysses S. Grant during the presidential campaign of 1872. The Doric Church on the right, which was on a trust lot here, is now a parking deck, and the Doric Church on the left remains as it was 142 years ago. The monument to Nathaniel Greene, the obelisk, is just out of the photograph on the left. We're out of time, and that puts us exactly one lecture behind. So I will have to make up some time in over the coming weeks. This afternoon or tonight, early, I will post the second assignment, the second exam for the graduate students only, the essay, and the instructions will be quite clear, and I am open to questions after class if anyone has any questions on that. Are there any questions about Savannah? Do you see the significance of what we have to learn from it? What's the dimension of a parking? What's the most efficient in terms of vehicles per acre or hectare for parking? Does anybody know? Construction Tech 2 veterans know. 60 feet. All right? 60 feet. So you can pluck out a building, put in a parking lot, wait until the new economic use shows up, put a new building in there. No? Do you think that the parking lot across the street over here is going to be permanent? If you come back to campus for homecoming 30 years from now, that'll be a parking lot? No. So if you have a system that can accommodate parking in the most efficient way possible, that also accommodates a wide variety of building types in the future that you can't imagine, you can't predict right now what they will be, you're leaving that future open while stabilizing the constitutional frame. Okay.